WILL programming is made possible by Midas Auto Service Center, 304 West University Avenue in Urbana, near the U of I campus, with shuttle service available. Regular preventative maintenance ensures a safe and reliable vehicle and makes a difference in driving costs. Information on Midas's preventative maintenance program is available at 367-0300.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of the show, we'll be taking up a topic we certainly have discussed before on other occasions with other guests. We'll be talking about energy, talking a little bit about the global demand for energy, how we meet that demand, and also a little bit about how Illinois fits in both on the demand and the production side. And we have two guests with us here in the studio this morning, Drs. Robert Skinner and Robert Finley. Robert Skinner recently resigned from the directorship of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. That's Oxford University. He was trained in geology and climate studies. He served for 6 years as director of the Policy and Planning Directorate of the International Energy Agency in Paris and is well known as an expert on energy and the environment. Dr. Robert Finley is head of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. And both of them are here, in a sense, because we are taking advantage of a series of talks that have been going on here on the campus of the university to mark the 100th anniversary of the Illinois State Geological Survey. And a number of speakers have come from outside of Champaign-Urbana, and we have talked with some of them, and we'll continue. I think there are just a couple more of people that will be speaking in the series that will be here on the program. And we're glad to have them here as well here this morning. The number, if you're going to call and you're here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have the possibility here of taking people from outside of Champaign-Urbana. We do have a toll-free line, and if you want to call, we'll pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. So either way, whether you're here in Champaign-Urbana or any place else that you can hear us, you can call in. Again, 333-WILL or 9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and also toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
To start in globally, obviously this is a big question, but can we say a little something, and maybe Dr. Skinner would like to take a shot in and to talk a little bit about the global demand for energy. Just say something about what it is now and how we're expecting that over the next, 10, 20 years, however far out you want to go, how much we expect that demand to grow from the point where it is now.
We actually consume about a little over 10 billion tons of oil equivalent. That's all forms of energy, coal, oil, gas, and nuclear and hydro, renewables, and so on. And about 80%, a little over 80% of that energy is fossil fuels. That's coal, oil, and gas. Oil is the largest. And the growth, the projected growth, should about double by 2030. Okay, so, and 85% of that growth will be fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. Gas is the fastest growing. But oil will remain the dominant share of all primary energy. In terms of oil, we consume about 84 million barrels a day. That's 1,000 barrels a second.
Oh, when you say we, do you mean
the world?
The world. Okay,
the world.
Good. Yeah. I don't want to experience people were hearing that and they weren't thinking, what does that mean in the United States? So we're talking about world,
that's
global
right.
consumption.
That's right.
Okay.
Now that 84 million barrels a day, the United States consumes about 20.5
of the total.
Right.
I guess I would have thought that it would actually have been more than that.
No, it's about a quarter, 25%.
Okay.
It's important to note that the U.S. is 4% of the world's population, yet we consume about 25% of the world's oil.
Well, that's the point. I guess that's what I was thinking about, the fact that it is often pointed out, sometimes just as a point of information and sometimes as a criticism. That sort of relationship. So again, so we're talking about the global situation. there is tremendous energy usage. We're expecting that going to go up. And even though we talk a lot about other sources, renewables particularly, some people, you know, like the idea of renewables for their green impact, that we're still heavily dependent and will continue to be heavily dependent for a long time on fossil fuels, particularly on oil. Right?
That's right. In fact, if you looked at those 10, 11 billion tons of oil equivalent energy, the two largest entries, if you like, of the energy balance sheet of the world are the oil in the United States, which is about 900 million tons of oil a year, and the other one is coal in China. Those two countries and those two fuels really sum up the kind of energy, climate, CO2 emissions challenge the world faces. And they are just a little under 20% or, say, 18% of that total energy consumption in the world. These two countries, those two fuels. Extraordinary.
Yeah. Let me go on to the – we talked a little bit about demand. We talked about how the demand's going to increase. We talked about the fact that we're thinking for the foreseeable future that we're still going to be mostly reliant on fossil fuels, particularly oil, but perhaps also gas, natural gas. Then the question becomes, well, let's look at the supply side. And we have, I think, been hearing now more and more concerns, particularly when it comes to oil, that we are coming to the point where we're at some kind of turning point in terms of production, and that we have gotten, at least that we're getting to the point where we've gotten most of the oil that's easy to get. That's not to say that there isn't still oil that's out there, but we're talking about having to apply different sorts of technologies. It's going to be more difficult. It's going to be more costly. I wonder what your take is on the notion of peak oil, and that some people are arguing that, you know, we've come to the point where you look at the production curve, it goes up, 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 and suddenly we get to the point where it's not going to go up anymore, and either it's going to start to turn down, or perhaps there's going to be a plateau for a while, but that we're at a definite point where it's not going to keep production is not going to keep going up as it has, and it's going to be more difficult and more costly to get the oil that's still there. And what's your take on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I was really happy to hear you use the word plateau, because very few commentators reflect that reality. The problem with the peak oil concept is it's very dramatic. It says to editors of newspapers, here today, gone tomorrow. It's a great headline. It therefore is a great lever for special interest groups to say, look, we're running out of oil, therefore you've got to do something. And politicians love to do something dramatic when they confront a crisis. And this peak concept is a crisis concept, whereas in reality it is not. And the peak oil advocates have to keep putting off that date. You know, it was peaking in 93, it was peaking in 98, and so on. And so they're doing the issue a great disservice. It is a real concern. I mean, you're quite right. The easy oil is getting more and more difficult, and we are having to move to the difficult oil, the oil sands in Canada and so on. And a lot of these, a lot of people don't look at those so-called unconventional oil, but they are very expensive and they're going to be very slow in coming on. And Rob, what's your
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We know about a lot of resources, but that we can produce in the future, the so-called unconventional resources, but these resources are difficult to access. The tar sands in Canada require energy for their extraction. There is a lot of heavy oil in the Orinoco Delta area of Venezuela. That oil can be accessible in the future. But again, it's both an issue of access. And then you have to also remember that some of these unconventional oils are different than the so-called light oil that we've produced historically for decades, and that when motor gasoline is one of the primary products that we consume on a global scale in the largest quantities, some of these heavy oils that we can get from the tar sands and from the tar belts and some of these other places, the kind of oil, that oil is heavier, it has less of a gasoline fraction in it, it's more difficult to refine. So we not only have a change in the accessibility of the resource, we also have a change in the character of the resource that's going to affect our ability to continue to provide the kinds of petroleum products, very gasoline-dominated, that we've become used to over a period of decades.
Mm-hmm. Just to kind of put those sort of easy oil and difficult oil into perspective, depending on whose assessment you believe, we have about 1.5 trillion barrels of so-called conventional oil. Recoverable left, apparently. The Venezuelan and Canadian ultra-heavy oil at tar sands together are probably anywhere between 2.5 and 3 trillion barrels of stuff in place, maybe about 600 billion barrels of recoverable using current technologies. And then you have all the other stuff, the gas to liquids from these sort of stranded gas fields. That's another 300 billion barrels of recoverable liquids. But the issue that Rob touches on is critical, because what we've got to do with all that stuff is add hydrogen to it, because it's mostly carbon. We've got to increase the hydrogen-carbon ratio. Most of the hydrogen we have today comes from natural gas, and that's another problem, because North America, for example, has hit the wall in terms of gas supply. And another problem is that we need the refineries that have the right kind of equipment to break those molecules of carbon and stick in hydrogen atoms. And those are cokers and crackers. And a lot of folks don't want to have refineries built near them, and they don't even want to have a refinery go through a huge remake and add stuff. So we face a challenge in North America.
Mm-hmm. And that capacity is really critical, as the Hurricane Katrina Rita experience showed us, that when just a fraction of our refining capacity goes offline, as it did during those storms, we face a very serious situation in terms of getting the refined products that we need. And in effect, we were bailed out by redirections of cargoes from Europe and so forth that brought us not just crude oil, but actually brought us refined product to replace those which could not be made by those refineries.
Mm. Well, I'm interested. It's interesting to hear you say that, because I think that in the recent past and some of the things that the president has said about energy policy, he talked about the need for more refinery capacity. And it seemed to me that there was maybe some disagreement, at least among people I heard talk about this, about whether in fact there was a shortage of refinery capacity. And whether if we had more refineries, if we built some more, whether that would have much influence on the supply of, well, I think the things where people were concerned about was gasoline to power internal combustion engines, whether that would really make very much difference. What I hear you saying is that, yes, in fact, that it would make difference if we had more refineries, or if they were different kinds of refineries, given the kind of oil that we're looking at.
The refineries in the U.S. Gulf Coast are the most sophisticated refineries in North America, and they're the ones that have the capacity to process that heavy Mexican and Venezuelan crude into gasoline and light products. And that was what happened when they took them out with the hurricanes. We were desperate for gasoline. Those refineries, the North American refineries, were running at 94-95% capacity. Now, you don't run an engineering system forever at 94-95% capacity. You've got to add more capacity because demand is going up. Mm-hmm. And either you're going to add more refining capacity in North America, the United States, or you're going to be importing gasoline from where they can add capacity, and they're actually doing that now in the Middle East. So here we'll be relying on gasoline coming from the Middle East. Well, that's fine. But maybe you want to process crude here and give you greater flexibility in terms of kind of products you need seasonally, you know, heating oil in the winter and gasoline in the summer. So on.
We have a couple of callers. We have several. I want to get right to them. Let me just real quick ask one more question. Given if what we're talking about is we're going to continue to be relying on oil, particularly for transportation applications. And that we're coming to the point where we've gotten a lot of the easy oil and we're going to go after the more difficult oil, which is going to be, if you look at what's involved in getting it out of the ground and processing it, it's going to be more expensive. Recently, we've seen some pretty significant spikes in the price, which has resulted in higher prices for energy, particularly at the pump. We're now being told, don't be surprised if this summer same thing happens again. Are we looking at, do you think, given the kind of forces that we're talking about, a long-term, should we expect a long-term and permanent increase in the price of oil? And what do you think that's going to be?
My own view on that is that I think we've stepped up into a new pricing terrace, if you like. I don't think we're going to go back to the $22, $25, $30 range unless there's an Armageddon-type scenario with avian flu, pandemic worldwide, that kind of very low probability but high-impact event. I think that for the simple reason that OPEC is far more disciplined now than they were in the 70s, and the Saudis in particular will want to maintain a price band somewhere between $45 and $55, that they will manage that. They need those kinds of revenues to grow, and also it seems that the world can manage $45, $50, $65 oil, is doing okay, although there are some early signs that perhaps demand is eroding and it's having some economic impacts here and there. But so on the demand side, I see the ability of the world to absorb it, and on supply side, that's the kind of price they need, and they'll defend that price. Mm-hmm. And we need that price for the oil sands as well, although we can produce oil sands in Canada at certainly less than $40 a barrel.
Yeah. Well, that seems sort of modest considering that what was the price, the high that we hit?
It was about $70.
That's what I'm thinking, that it was about $70. Well, it sounds like, as if you were saying, well, that was a result of a rather unusual set of circumstances. That was not exactly normal.
No, it certainly wasn't normal. And I think what in addition to what Bob's saying is you are, whenever you remove that intrinsic cushion of spare capacity in a critical commodity like oil, you're going to have more volatility. So at the same time, while the trajectory, as Bob has indicated, is clearly going up, I think at the same time we can also expect to see volatility based on either geopolitical events, potential attacks on major facilities, perhaps in the Middle East, if that were to come to pass, or as we saw in the case of Cortina, natural events that basically take out supply. We are still, as we sit here this morning, we're still several hundred thousand barrels a day of production offline with respect to our Gulf of Mexico capability, both in oil and natural gas, mm-hmm. because of the damage to the infrastructure. So this, when you don't have that spare capacity, either domestically or within the global market, we'll not only see higher prices, we'll be subject to greater volatility.
I think that's the key point. I think history will look back on this price surge, price shock, if you call it that, and say, really, the important thing was not so much the demand surge from China in particular, but really was the disappearance of spare capacity, not only in crude production, but also in transportation and in refining, all through the chain. And that, you know, that just, you know, the record profits that are being reported by the oil companies for last year, for 2005, and they're coming out now, these are not because of, not for effort or things that they did last year, but rather for things that were not done in the whole oil industry over the last 15, 20 years, and that's invest in capital and capacity. And why would they invest in capacity when they had 5, 10 million barrels a day off and on of spare capacity in OPEC? And so and prices were low, so that investment didn't take place. Demand came along. We had some strikes in Norway, Nigeria even, and in Venezuela, and other losses of supply, and that just pinched away that spare capacity. You can't run any system at 95%.
We have several callers. In fact, the lines are full. So let me introduce our two guests once again, and we'll start talking with callers. We're talking this morning with Dr. Robert Skinner and Dr. Robert Finley, Dr. Skinner, recently resigned from the directorship of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. He also has served as the director of the Policy and Planning Directorate of the International Energy Agency in Paris. And Dr. Robert Finley, he is head of the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. He is an expert on Illinois' position in the global energy marketplace. Let me mention, too, that the two of them will be talking about the future of energy resources in the world and Illinois this afternoon at 3:30 in room 100 of Noyes Laboratory of Chemistry on the U of I campus. That's 505 South Matthews. And anyone who was interested in attending should feel welcome. Again, this is another one of those programs in a series that have been going on now over the past few months to mark the 100th anniversary of the Illinois State Geological Survey, which is based here on the campus of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Questions are welcome, and we have a number, and we'll start right in with someone in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
What you've just now discussed is part of what I was hoping to bring up. In fact, I'd like to update a fact that's always stuck in my head from the shock of the 1973 OPEC embargo and gasoline price increase. At that time, if I remember correctly, people were upset at the then cost, increased cost of a barrel of oil up to, I think, $10 or $12 per barrel, because the price, the cost, rather, of extracting a barrel of oil out of Saudi Arabia was said to be only about $3 a barrel. Now, I'm not sure if that's accurate, but I would like your estimates of what it is, what is the current cost of producing a barrel of oil out of Saudi Arabia as the cost of, say, a barrel of easy oil, and how much has that changed over the last 30 years?
Okay.
Actually, back in the 70s, we used to say it costs about 45 cents a barrel in Saudi Arabia.
Oh.
And now, if we look at capital costs, another way of looking at it, rather than looking at it per barrel, the cheapest oil produced in the world, obviously, is in Saudi Arabia. It's about $4,000 per barrel per day capacity. Okay, and if it's by comparison, the oil sands in Canada costs anywhere between $25,000 to $35,000 per barrel per day capacity. Now, in Saudi Arabia, we'd say, okay, that's about $2.50, $3 a barrel. They will say sometimes it's less, but here in the United States, the cost is about anywhere between $12 and $15, $16 a barrel. So, yes, there's a great ceiling above that, but you don't run oil at the basis on the basis of cost.
No, that's the production cost. The demand cost is why I guess it's up to $60 and $70 a barrel. People are bidding, and the highest bidder gets the barrel of oil.
Well, that's exactly right. It's a globalized marketplace, and oil is, as the economists say, it's a fungible commodity. It's a barrel here is just as saleable as a barrel in China, and it's been well known that even oil in tankers on the high seas have been diverted in transit from the loading point to the marketplace based on the shift in the market on a daily basis. So, with electronic trading and the internet and electronic communications instantaneously on a global scale, these cargoes can literally be diverted to the most advantageous market on a moment's notice.
But to update the little factoid in my memory, currently, 2006, the range of production cost is between $3 or so to $12 or so for the easiest oil to extract from the ground.
Yeah, that's probably a reasonable set of numbers.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to the next caller, Lovington. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
You were talking about hydrogen a moment ago, and I missed the first part of the program. There are some engines being developed. They are injecting hydrogen into, increases the efficiency of them by 30% or so. Is that something that is coming onto the market, or is that purely experimental, and where is the hydrogen for that coming from?
Well, hydrogen is, as you know, probably I'm sure, is a fuel that's being considered for future use in a variety of ways. One of the most efficient ways of hydrogen consumption is within a fuel cell, where basically the hydrogen is oxidized to water. And some of the major automakers, GM and others, have suggested they're in the process of developing fuel cell cars for future use and for transportation uses. You can actually buy fuel cell electric generators at the current point in time. The question of where the hydrogen comes from is a very good one. And for industrial processes in refining, hydrogen has been historically extracted from natural gas. But with increased natural gas prices, in many ways that no longer makes sense. There are technologies that can extract hydrogen from coal cleanly. And there is even the potential to perhaps use solar energy with the electrolysis of water to produce hydrogen, although when you look at it on a full cycle basis, it's not as efficient as one might expect. But I'm not familiar with the technology of actually using hydrogen directly in any kind of current engines per se, but it'd most likely be used in a fuel cell environment.
Well, I get a farm magazine that had pictures of diesel motors that have been developed. It actually showed the unit mounted onto the motor that injects hydrogen into the motor, and they're claiming a minimum of 30% efficiency on them.
Yeah,
and have tried them in gasoline motors, and I think it's in Europe that they're doing that.
Yeah, I think there was some research done back in the 80s, 70s of injecting a fine mist of steam in with pulverized coal, and you can do the same with fuel oil and diesel. If you inject hydrogen, water, which is basically hydrogen and oxygen, and you, in a high temperature environment, you could get dissociation, and you can get that energy kick from the hydrogen in that fuel mixture. But and I've heard something about it, but I must say that it seems to me a bit strange that it would be pure hydrogen injected into a tractor or a truck, because you've got to get hydrogen, and that's one of the big challenges that the hydrogen economy faces, and that is how do you produce the stuff and how do you store it?
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
All right, well, let's go to, we have someone on a cell phone here in Edgar County, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. You mentioned that the United States has reached or hit a wall with respect to natural gas supplies, and you could certainly make that argument with respect to domestic crude oil supplies, but would you consider this so-called wall to be in part artificial because of the massive amounts of properties onshore and offshore United States that are off limits to drilling and exploration?
Yes, I would say that. In fact, I'm glad you raised that, sir, because many North American politicians go around saying the big issue is access. Our oil companies need access around the world to various countries' oil and gas resources. And yet, if you look at home here in North America, and my accent might not betray it, I'm a Canadian. There are parts of Canada where we don't have access for the industry. The West Coast, East Coast of the United States, the West Coast of Florida, large parts of the San Juan Basin, Rocky Mountain Basin are either difficult to access for the industry. So yes, quite true. It is a self-imposed constraint. And speaking from the moon and speaking from Oxford, I look at it and I say the solution is to say, look, let the coastal states have the benefits of oil and gas development off their coast rather than the federal government. And because you're asking the coastal states to take the risk, so why don't you give them the benefits?
And the same could apply to the Arctic Refuge in Alaska, correct?
Well, the ANWR debate is a very sensitive issue, and if you've ever been there, you would appreciate why the porcupine and caribou herd is something rather magical and special, and it's a very unique environment. And actually, if you were to be successful in discovering oil there, it would amount to a small contribution to the U.S. oil independence, or whatever you want to call it. And the U.S. Department of Energy has done a detailed study on that, and it's fairly obvious. And I think, quite frankly, if I were a major oil company and I had service stations scattered around the United States, I would not recommend that we go rushing up there to explore for oil, because it would not be very good public relations.
Well, and real quickly, with respect to, you know, North America as a whole and the offshore and onshore lands that are off limits, for all we know, this so-called easy oil and gas has not been completely found.
Well, I'm not sure I would say that, because I think we have, over a period of time, done enough surveys and assessments to know that, yeah, there probably are some large accumulations, say, particularly off the west coast of Florida, that may not have been drilled or that have only had one or two wells drilled in them. But I think, by and large, the North American continent, and particularly the U.S., is the most intensely drilled piece of real estate on Earth. And I think geologists and the companies have a pretty good understanding of where those resources are located. And studies have shown that, you know, it's easy to find the elephants. It's easy to find the big targets. And there's probably enough drilling on this continent now that we know that probably there aren't too many big accumulations left. The only place in the lower 48 we might see that is possibly in the deep offshore waters, the deep Gulf of Mexico, the continental slope beyond the shelf, that there may be some large accumulations we haven't found yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. And as far as world supplies go, it's not the case that somebody thinks that out there somewhere in the world there's some great oil field that we don't know is there?
That's pretty hard to count on that, and I think that's wishful thinking. You know, we've got to start looking in the mirror and facing reality, rather than just saying, well, there's some magical thing that's going to happen and we're going to make this magical discovery. The world has been fairly well discovered or explored. There will be some nice discoveries made in the deep offshore areas that we haven't really looked at yet, but in the difficult areas off Greenland, that's a dicey environment, but there's some possibilities there. The big issue is that here in North America, we consume over 25% of the world's oil, and we have 3 to 4% of the reserves. Okay, we consume a third of the natural gas in the world. We have less than 5% of the reserves. So here we are looking at a future of dependence on the rest of the world. By 2015, perhaps 60 to 75% of the oil and gas in the world will be coming from Russia, Middle East, and North Africa, and West Africa. Mm. Now that says an awful lot about foreign policy, about the geopolitics of energy, about how we look at our consumption of oil and gas and energy, and also about our role in the global environment. And you know, those are fairly stark facts. And the globe is the globe. That's it. We don't have another one. And it's given up an awful lot of oil and gas to us. And there isn't a magic solution out there. Yes, technology is going to make it cheaper and or not, you know, less expensive than it should be. And we're going to find bits and pieces more. But the big magic plum is not on the horizon. Yeah.
Well, let's talk with some other callers here. Well, next we'll talk with someone in Indiana on our toll-free line. That's line 4. Hello.
In terms of the thing you just mentioned about the United States having a certain percentage of oil reserve or oil and how much it uses on the global scale, what can you say about India and China? How much coal, natural gas, you know, whatever that's necessary, do they have in their percentages in relationship to their actual global use? And can you go out on the way out on that limb to talk about this wonderful triumvirate that's going to eventually do something geopolitical of importance? How long do you think we got before things will get heavy? Thanks.
Well, that's a very good question. India and China are, you know, 2.2 billion people. They are basically coal economies. China's the largest coal consumer in the world, over a billion tons a year. And India is a big coal consumer. They are not yet large oil consumers, although China is consuming about 6.5, maybe large for their size, 6.5 million barrels a day. It's the second largest importer after the United States, and it's going to get bigger. But they're also going to be big importers of natural gas, and they are along with us, very dependent on someone else's oil and gas.
Yeah, it's important to note that China's market for automobiles is growing at the rate of 50% of the year. It's the highest rate of growth in automobile sales in the world. So you can take that out a number of decades, and you can see very easily where that's going.
We have about 15 minutes left, and maybe again I should introduce our guests, Drs. Robert Skinner and Robert Finley. Dr. Skinner, he recently resigned from the directorship of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. He was trained in geology and climate studies, served for 6 years as director of the Policy and Planning Directorate of the International Energy Agency in Paris. Dr. Robert Finley heads the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey and is an expert on Illinois' position in the global energy marketplace. Just let me ask you for a second. Illinois in the past certainly has historically been a fairly significant coal producer. There was a time. There is some natural gas. I think people might even be surprised to know that Illinois is an oil-producing state. It maybe not, you know, not big compared with Texas, for example, but there actually is oil in Illinois.
Right.
Given that, again, we have this kind of demand that can perhaps support a higher price for some of these commodities, is there some possibility that Illinois might be, again, a significant producer of fossil fuels?
Well, that's a really good comment, David. In the word, yes, and particularly with regard to coal, because Illinois has the largest bituminous coal resource of any state in the U.S. So we are sitting on, in terms of the energy, the heat content, we're sitting on as much BTUs in terms of coal as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait combined have basically in terms of oil. The issue with Illinois coal, I think most people know Illinois coal has declined significantly in production. It's declined by half or so in the last 12 years to about 32 million tons per year current production, largely because of the fact that Illinois coal contains a fairly significant amount of sulfur, 2 to 3, 4% sulfur. The Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 specifically mandated that sulfur had to be removed. So the sulfur content of Illinois coal requires now certainly that coal goes to power plants that have scrubbers that can basically take the sulfur dioxide that results from the combustion of that coal, take it out of the flue gas, and avoid its emission to the atmosphere. It's interesting for folks to know that we generate about 45% of our electricity in the state of Illinois from coal, but 80% of that coal actually comes from Wyoming. It's not our own coal. And the coal that we do mine largely goes to power plants in Florida and other states, the Tennessee Valley Authority, where they can put that coal into power plants that have scrubbers. But the critical technology for use of coal, there's some really new innovative technologies on the horizon that we call coal gasification, which is not the simple combustion of coal in atmospheric conditions. It is more the conversion of coal to a synthetic gas, if you will, that consists of carbon monoxide and hydrogen, and that we can burn that gas in turbines. We can separate the CO2. We basically get water as a combustion byproduct. We can take the sulfur and the mercury out prior to the time that the syngas goes to the combustion turbines and therefore avoid some of the atmospheric emission problems. The good BTU content, 10 to 12,000 BTU per pound of Illinois coal, makes it an exceptionally good fuel for this process. And we really see that coal gasification process as something that can lead to a resurgence in use of Illinois coal, and not only for electric generation, but for the production of hydrogen, which can be exported then from the plant. This is the concept of the Bush administration's Future Gen concept, which is a demonstration of this technology that Illinois and is in competition with other states to land that project here in Illinois. If we do so, I think that would be a tremendous leg up for both the nation and for Illinois in terms of taking advantage of those that energy content of that secure known fuel that we have here in the state.
Hmm. Now, though, don't you still have a problem? And if correct me if I didn't understand this right, you still have a problem, though. You've got carbon dioxide that you have to do something
right,
with,
right?
Which you don't want going out in the atmosphere because it's a greenhouse gas, and we got a problem with that already.
Yeah. Well, gasification is very beneficial in that regard. The reason is when you burn coal in a conventional pulverized coal plant, the technology that you see out there today, that flue gas is only 12 to 14% CO2, because all air is 80% nitrogen, so all that nitrogen moves through and it's very dilute. With gasification, you can get a 90% pure CO2 stream. You can separate that carbon dioxide, and which is which if you were to do this at a conventional coal plant is very, very expensive and difficult to do. And the process is one of the major projects we've got going at the Geological Survey right now is looking at geological carbon sequestration. We're looking at the opportunity literally to take this carbon dioxide, liquefy it, and put it back in some of these deep rock formations well below where the coal is currently mined from, but deep rock formations that have nothing in them now but salt water that's 2 to 3 times the salinity of seawater. Essentially, we're in a process of cradle-to-grave carbon management. The carbon molecules in the coal are being utilized for energy, and basically we're putting that carbon back in the ground. So again, the gasification technology is very amenable to avoiding the CO2 emissions, which is one of the big drawbacks of coal.
Okay. Well, I would like to ask some more questions about that, but we have some other people here who have questions too. So let's go on. Next is someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah. The last thing you were talking about was very interesting, but I have a question sort of along those lines, and that is that about a week or two ago, CBS Evening News had this really great little in-depth report where they talked about Brazil, and they talked about how back in the 70s, Brazil decided to invest into research into ethanol from sugarcane, and that they eventually mapped the genome of sugarcane to the point that they expect to, and apparently, and this is what I'm clear on, apparently they expect to be completely independent of oil this year, not next year or 10 years from now, but this year with their flex cars and all, but based on ethanol from sugarcane, which they, like I said, they mapped the genome. And what I don't understand, and they didn't make clear in this news item of theirs, and if it isn't a Brazilian state secret or something, what I'm wondering if your guests know whether or not this genetic research is really directly involved in the success of their ethanol program, because they didn't make that clear. And then two, though they kind of implied it, and two, I wanted to know what's the theoretical capacity for us to do something similar with, I guess, corn or some other renewable crop, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
That's the Brazilian story on ethanol is actually getting a lot of attention, and it had early problems in the 70s. As for the question on whether they've used this genetic engineering or the mapping of the cane genome as part of that, I'd say no, because most of that ethanol program started earlier, and it's now taken off because oil prices are high. As for the comment that Brazil is now free of oil dependence or whatever, that is actually not correct. What's happened is the oil consumption in Brazil is about 1.5 million barrels a day, and they've made some significant deep offshore discoveries, and so they are now a net exporter or about to become a net exporter of oil. I think they'll be producing about 1.7 million barrels a day by 2010. Now, that ethanol, which is about 200 and some odd thousand barrels a day of ethanol, it goes into their gasoline pool, into these, as you correctly say, these flex fuel vehicles. And that is taking off. But on the other hand, the price of sugar is going up. And the corn farmers here in the Midwest, they face the same problem for ethanol because when the price of corn goes up, then the ethanol becomes quite expensive, but it then needs more subsidies. but on the other hand, if you're a farmer and you're in an ethanol co-op, that's kind of good because when the price of corn goes down, then you're making some money on your share in the ethanol co-op. One of the things you have to remember about ethanol is a gallon of ethanol only has the energy of about 60% of a gallon of gasoline. So it's you have to produce a lot of ethanol. Yes, actually the most economic ethanol comes from sugar cane, and there are a lot of countries in the world close to the equator that are capable of growing cane. And at $50 a barrel for crude oil, this cane sugar-derived ethanol is quite economic and is the way to go for many of those countries.
Okay. Well, nobody gets to the question of the call. Let's go to Matt Toon for somebody else here. Line four. Hello.
Yeah. I'm old enough to live through the 70s gas shortage, and I always was wondering about in the 70s, there's always gas lines and everything else, but anymore, hell, people are running all the time, and it seems like there really ain't no shortage. If you got the money, we'll sell you the gas, and we're consuming a lot more gas now than we did in the 70s. I was always wondering what's really going on that part.
Well, in a sense, we've got the supply. We're it's a much more fully integrated global market than there is now. But the price really today is really a function of two things. It's the end of the easily accessible oil, combined with the growth in demand, particularly from the developing countries of the world. So when you talk about price and supply, there's today, that equation has probably got a lot more variables in it than it had back at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things in the 70s, it was very much a panic environment. And you could cause a crisis today simply by having everybody in America go out and fill up the car. And that's actually what happened in some markets in the United States in the 70s. In 78, 79, and the Iranian crisis, California had a crisis, had the lineups, as you quite correctly remember, sir. And the reason that happened was that the California refineries were running heavy Alaskan oil in 70. They started running it in 77, 78, 79, and they were producing a lot of residual oil. The residual oil tanks at the refineries filled up, and so they couldn't process any more crude and make any more gasoline. So they kind of had to stop sending tank trucks out to the petrol stations, and a few petrol stations said we'd have no gas. And, of course, then that invoked panic. And we were a function of information and misinformation, and people ran out and tanked up their cars, and that compounded the crisis. And that's the worst thing that we as consumers can do, is when there's a hurricane and a slight hiccup in a very tight system, is to all run out and hooray for me and the heck with everybody else and tank up our car, because that'll just compound the crisis.
Okay, let's talk again with someone here. Next is in Jasper County, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. He's talking about high sulfur coal. We have a power plant here in the county. Has there been any research done on burning corn, mixing out with high sulfur coal, or using corn as just a fuel for power plants? There's a lot of people burning corn in their homes and farm shops and stuff like that. I understand that there's as much BTUs or more BTUs in a pound of corn than there is a pound of coal. You got any comments on that?
Yes. I think the research has been done to date is not so much using the corn kernel itself, because of the value of that corn kernel to either go into a food product or a feed product or go into the ethanol plant. But what has been looked at very closely is to use some of the exocellulose, the plant matter itself, whether it's the corn stalk and the leaves that could be harvested. And actually, the Geological Survey has done some work on the possibility of taking waste coal fines, the very fine material that comes out of a coal preparation plant that's ultimately left over, combining that with the cellulose from waste fiber from the corn plant and even the waste fiber from other types of biocrops like switchgrass, compressing that almost into a briquette, if you will, and feeding that to certain types of power plants. So the answer is yes, I think that's viable, and it's particularly viable given that we take the so-called waste fines that are just the very fine, almost powdery coal that is left over from coal prep plant processing and using that. And it actually has some beneficial qualities in terms of the combustion of that material and the amount of emissions that you get. And it actually helps reduce those emissions. So,
but by using what you're calling waste, the stalk, the leaves of a corn plant, you're removing organic matter that can be left on the soil for water, soil erosion. You're taking nutrients off of the property, which is going to cost the farmer more to put back those nutrients. Wouldn't it be better just to use the kernel itself and just burn it as a source?
Well, possibly so, and you're exactly right about the nutrients. But I think right now, at the current point in time, I think the demand, particularly with the renewable fuel portfolio standard and the phase-out of what's called MBTE, a component of gasoline, I would be a little surprised if the market would look to a demand for corn kernels to burn as opposed to ethanol.
What about using the dried distiller's grain that's left over from the alcohol plant? Would that be a viable fuel?
Yeah, I think people are actually looking at drying and compressing that again to make some kind of feedstock.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. I think we're at the point we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we have one more caller that we cannot take. Maybe we have about a minute or so. I guess maybe I'll just turn to the guests and say there's some final thought that you'd just like to leave people with as a way of finishing up.
Well, I think there's a tendency for people to look to governments to come up with some policies, and I guess my advice would be just breathe in deeply and be very careful about what you ask governments to do. I think there's lots of room for government-industry partnership in looking at some of these technologies that, for example, Rob is talking about here in Indiana and coal, using what you have. So my advice would just take it easy.
Yeah, and I guess what I would add to that is a key word is diversity, because I think if we ever get to the point where we feel like there may be just one renewable fuel solution to our current fossil fuel usage, if anybody's telling you that one single type of replacement of renewables could totally displace our fossil fuel usage, I think I would be skeptical. What we really need is a portfolio of new technologies, ability to use a diversity of fuel, and only with that diversity, using renewables, fossil, even considering nuclear electric generation, if it's appropriate, given that Illinois, for example, gets half its electricity from nuclear, the most of any state in the country, which few people realize. So I would say diversity is a key issue.
All right. Well, we are going to stop there. Our guests this morning, Robert Skinner, he's former director of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, and Robert Findlay, he heads the Energy and Earth Resources Center at the Illinois State Geological Survey. The two of them will be talking about the future of energy resources in the world and in Illinois this afternoon at 3:30. This is room 100 of the Noyes Lab of Chemistry on South Matthews in Urbana. Anyone is interested should feel welcome to attend. This is, again, another one of those events that is marking the 100th anniversary of the Illinois State Geological Survey. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Here. Thank you.
Today's broadcast made possible with support from World Harvest Foods, celebrating 6 years at 6th and University in Champaign, with an anniversary tasting event on Saturday, April 8th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Over 100 items will be featured, including cheeses, olives, chocolates, baklava, and more. Programming also made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. That's it for us. Up next, though, more news and information.